great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome accomplished producer, engineer, author, and educator, Bobby Ozinski. Bobby is here to talk about the status of the music industry and his latest book, Music 4.0, a survival guide for making music in the internet age. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Flo to the Izzo Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great show for you tonight. Scott, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I just want to remind our listeners that we are giving away two signed books by Bobby, the Music 4.0 book. So go to our flowguitarenthusiast.com quick, soon, and fast, and in a hurry to make sure you sign up, and then we'll be choosing the winner and then announcing those in the middle of the show. And I just posted up a video from last week with Dan Boole and Frank Falvo playing their new Color Boost.
Yeah, I was really impressed with that. The sound of those germaniums just had the punch. I have never heard a pedal have that kind of punch to it, where it sounded like you're driving tubes pretty hard. It sounded really impressive to me.
Yeah, it's a really, really nice pedal. I mean, you can hear it quite well there. We played it through a couple different amps, the Quilter, which is a solid-state amp, and then a 65-amp London.
Yeah.
Which sounds good by itself already. So.
And we also, behind the scenes on that, after the show, Frank showed us some of the guitars that he designed. And he has a really interesting bridge design on his acoustic guitars, because normally the bridge pulls a little bit from the strings, especially like a 12-string, and you get this like warp eventually. Well, he has a way of putting its inset into the soundboard, and I'm going to be posting some pictures up of some of the guitars. We took some pictures after the show, and we definitely have to have him on for this because it's totally cool. But he basically negates the pressure on the bridge, and it's amazing. He's patented it and all that stuff, and it's really cool. You got to see this, and it sounded good. He had a dreadnought here, and it just resonated. It was really nice, and I was shocked because the strings are mounted into the soundboard, but it didn't hinder the vibration or anything. It was pretty cool. So it was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So, and anyway, this week I've been reading. Scott handed me the Bobby's book, and you got homework, so I did homework, and I was just totally blown away by this book. You guys, if you, we have the drawing coming up, so I urge you. This thing is invaluable. It just blew me away, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But that's what I've been up to.
Cool. And then just before we take a quick little break and bring Bobby on, I do want to remind everyone that in 2 weeks, June 16th, we have Billy Sheehan and Richie Kotzen from the Winery Dogs. They'll both be in here, hopefully with their guitar and bass, and doing some jams.
Yes, it should be fun. And then also, too, is it this weekend is the Gear Fest?
Yeah, this weekend at Sweetwater is the Gear Fest. So a lot of the people we've had on there, like Dan Boole and AEA is going to be down there, or AEA Ribbon Mics. And so I think, wasn't Mojave, too, is going to be down there?
Mojave's going to be down there. And I saw a posting that from Hal Leonard Publishing, because there's a book coming out. Bruce Sweetian's going to be down there, who used to engineer for Michael Jackson. He's a killer. I mean, he's done many other things, too. But, I mean, he wrote a book, I guess, about recording technique. And he's going to be down there. There's just a whole bunch of people are going to be down there. It is definitely the place to be.
Yep, definitely so. If you're out there, visit them in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Okay, well, let's take a break.
Yep.
And we'll be right back with our guest. Hang on a second.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here, one of the many guitar freaks at Sweetwater supporting the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show. Check out our amazing Gear Fest coming to Fort Wayne and Sweetwater next Friday and Saturday, June 6th and 7th. We'll have great guests like Billy Sheehan and Bruce Swedeen, among other greats like Kenny Arnoff and Bob Clearmountain. It's all free. Just go to sweetwater.com/gearfest for more info on all the amazing workshops and clinicians, or call us at 800-222-4700. This week, the Flow welcomes the prolific educator and author of Music 4.0, Bobby Ozinski. Like Bobby, Sweetwater is dedicated to music and music technology education, carrying lots of books and tutorials, support programs, and our very own Music Academy. At BobbyOzinski.com, there's also mucho info on how to perform, produce, and prosper in the music industry. So enjoy Bobby talking with Jeff and Scott, and don't forget to check us out online at Sweetwater.com/GearFest. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying, rock on with the flow.
Hola, amigos. Hello, everyone. My name is Billy Sheehan, and I'm from the Winery Dogs, and you're watching The Flow Guitar Enthusiasts.
All right, well, welcome back, and I just want to welcome officially Bobby Ozinski.
Thank you, Scott. It's truly a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yes.
No,
yes.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Jeff. I'm honored to be here.
And just want to give a little bit of your background because it's very, very impressive. He's taught at Berklee College, Trebus Recording Institute, Nova Institute, has been an audio recording and multimedia producer and engineer for years, co-founder of my favorite pet thing is of Surround Associates, and he's been a pioneer of surround sound. I'm a big surround sound friend. But I was telling him before the show, I first heard about him reading his articles in Recording Engineer Producer, also The Mix, Pro Sound News, Electronic Musician, Grammy, Film and Video. Those go on and on and on. It's truly a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thank Kenny for the nice intro as well.
Yes, I will let him know.
Yeah.
So your book is called Music 4.0, which you kind of refer to as there's different evolutions of the music industry. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the music industry is driven by technology. Not many people really understand that. And if you go back and you look, it started with music 0.5 basically was the beginning of the business where all they had was piano rolls and sheet music. But as soon as the record came out, and at the time it was the Shellac 78, the new technology, the Victrola, everything changed. And that became Music 1.0. And that was the way the music business went. It was the old music business that we all kind of know, where everything was based around the record label. You had to make a demo to get to the record label, and then the record label sold the records to the vinyl records at the time. They sold them to a retail store, and then they hired promotion to promote it on radio. And that's kind of the way that worked for a long, long time. And then around 1981, it all changed for two reasons. The CD came out. Again, technology changing. When the CD came out, all of a sudden, the record labels were rolling in money because what they did was they took their old back catalog and they just re-released it on a CD. And when they did that, they didn't have to pay marketing costs to promote it because people already knew what they're buying, and they didn't have to pay production costs to the band at all or the artist. So they're rolling in money. And Wall Street took notice. Next thing you know, Wall Street comes in and they start to buy up all the record labels. So one by one, they all fall. They all become part of a big conglomerate. And then MTV comes around. MTV, again, here we go, technology. MTV changes everything because it's a brand new avenue of promotion that comes out. So that was Music 1.5. Music 2.0 is the beginning of digital music. So this happens 1996, 97. When MP3s first come out. The only problem is there was no way to monetize that. And the record labels kind of ignored it because they're making so much money they didn't much care at that point. Bad mistake, as it turns out. The next thing that happened was Music 2.5. Music 2.5 is Apple iTunes. Finally, we can monetize digital files. A few years later, everything changes once more with social media. And now we have Music 3.0. Music 3.0 allows the artist, the band, to finally reach out directly to the fan, and the fan can reach back to them as well,
right,
with nobody in the middle. Music 3.5 changes a few years later, and that's YouTube. YouTube becomes a huge influence on music, because now suddenly people can get music for nothing online. They want to listen to something, they go online, they get it, and it becomes a big influence. And then we come up to what's now music 4.0, and that's streaming. And the world now is changing to streaming music. Downloads are going away at a very rapid pace. As a matter of fact, what we'll find is pretty soon CDs are going to outlast downloads. I predict, anyway. So that's music 4.0, and you can see how technology has changed, which means the business has changed every time.
Mm-hmm.
So probably what will happen, there'll be some new technology that we don't know about yet that will, again, take the music business into a new evolution.
Now, you mentioned iTunes. One of the things I've always kind of had a negative feeling towards iTunes, because I've felt that it has ruined the album as a whole. Do you feel that the iTunes and those sort of digital deliveries have ruined an album, or have they created something different?
They ruined the album experience, that's for sure. I wouldn't say they ruined it, they changed it. But one of the biggest problems that had happened with the CD is that because there was so much time, you can have 76 plus minutes, and artists suddenly felt they had to fill it up. So you went from records that had normally 35 to 45 minutes of material, but it was all really good. But nobody cared if there were six songs on it. It didn't matter.
Right.
So suddenly you had to have 10 songs or 12 songs on a CD with 50 minutes or so, and let's face it, a lot of it was filler. So the album experience, I think, was actually changed prior to downloads. I think it was changed with the CD, and a backlash from that was when people said, well, wait, I only want the two good songs. You know, I don't need the other nine filler songs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what downloads sort of liberated them from that. But it's no different than the beginning. If you go back to the 50s, you kind of had that same experience where it was a singles-driven industry.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting what you mentioned in the book, is that originally, even before the record, the singles record with the sheet music, it was a singles-driven, you bought the song, you bought the sheet music, and now it's totally turned back to a singles-driven type of medium where people are picking the singles.
And in streaming, let's face it, you know, you may have 30 million songs to choose from, but it's been proven that the 0.1% of those are the ones that are listened to. I don't remember what the figure was, but a huge number of those 20 or 30 million are only listened to once in a year. So I think it's something like 80%.
Wow.
So you may have, you know, a large catalog to choose from, but it doesn't mean people are actually choosing.
Right.
Stuff.
But when you set up your presence, like on iTunes or Amazon or something like that, do you still, because you mentioned that the CD is an important part, you know, as like merchandising for touring and stuff like that when you're playing live, and a lot of bands I know of, they sell them at the concerts. But if you're starting out as a you know, beginning artist or something like that, can you sustain yourself as a singles artist by posting, or do you really do still need to think of an album, or can you make a compilation later, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is changing also. Last year, if you would have asked me that, I would have said that a CD is necessary, and it's necessary for one reason, that's to get reviews, because many reviewers, either bloggers or traditional reviewers in traditional media, they didn't consider you real unless you had a physical product. But that's changed this year. And the more I talk to bloggers, the more they say, no, I don't want physical product. Just send me a link, like SoundCloud or, you know, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sufficient. So that's kind of changed. That being said, I do believe that a CD should be part of an artist's overall strategy, though. And the reason being, there's still a lot of people that buy CDs and will continue to buy them. To some degree, it's memorabilia. It's a collectible.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like they have something special, especially when they buy it at a gig or a concert. So there's still a huge market. It's bigger than we know. And if you actually look at the figures from last year, CDs were still more than 50% of the total sales in the music business in the world. Now, that's going down rapidly, but just think about this. Those are the figures that we can count, because we count everything via sound scan, but all of those acts that sell directly on their website or sell at the venues they play at, those aren't counted. So we don't actually know how many CDs are sold. It could be substantially more.
So iTunes and Amazon aren't counted? The sales? They don't... On SoundScan or...
Yeah, they are. But if you go play a gig tonight and you sell 10 CDs, those aren't counted.
Mm-hmm.
Or if on your website, if someone buys, you know, 10 CDs or a CD, it's not counted.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, for a band that's starting out and they want to have merchandise, what would you say are necessities that they should have as merchandise to promote themselves and make money?
Merch is really important. And unfortunately, artists, especially beginning artists, don't take it seriously enough. The first thing I would say is get some of the very, very high margin, inexpensive products. And those are stickers and patches and guitar picks, which are, you know, less than a buck a piece or, you know, quarter a piece, and you can sell for $3. You know, there's a 400% markup in this stuff, generally speaking. So it doesn't cost a lot of money out of pocket, and you can make a lot of money, and it's an impulse buy. As opposed to a T-shirt, which is necessary to some degree, but you can, you know, you have problems because there's a lot of inventory involved, which takes up space, and, you know, you need three sizes or two sizes at least, and different colors and things like that. The other thing is, of course, you need a really great design, and I think that's where a lot of beginning artists kind of fall down. They take that for granted and they don't get a design that's compelling. And nobody's going to buy our merch unless they really like what you're doing, first of all, but there's, you know, also a compelling design.
Mm-hmm. That's important, yeah, the total look of that. Initially, the CD isn't as critical, or is that part of the must-have?
Well, again, it depends on your audience. What I've found is, up until recently, country artists, for instance, it was mostly a CD as opposed to a download or digital music world. And that's kind of changed. It's turned on its ear in the last 12 months, maybe 18 months. But there are certain genres, for instance. One is hard rock, where for some reason, most of the audience much prefers to buy a CD than downloads. And there's a band I've produced three albums and a bunch of singles for them. They're called Snoo. And they proved that to me right in the beginning. We're doing the first album, I remember. And I said, look, let's just do some singles and we'll do digital music. And they said, no, our fans absolutely have to have an album. So anyway, the first couple singles come out digitally only. Nothing happens. Zero. There's no reviews. There's no traction. There's nothing. The CD comes out and it explodes. And all of a sudden they have 150 reviews. All of a sudden there's things happening that wouldn't have happened without the CD. Mm-hmm. And they just have an audience that wants the CD. That it's not just them. It's hard rock. Wants, mm-hmm. you know, CDs for some reason. So there are, you have to know your audience, because some audiences do want that and preferred. As opposed to other medium. But on the other hand, that's rapidly changing. You know, there's still a lot of people find the convenience of streaming to be something they can't live without.
Well, you were mentioning in the book, too, you mentioned that a lot of people are, that there's an upswing in vinyl. But is that still kind of a niche market even? Or is that, because I don't know that many people that have turntables now that, you know, from before when we all had turntables. You know what I'm saying? What do you think? Do you think that's, I mean, obviously that's probably not something initially they have, but do you think it's that big of a deal, or is that?
It's bigger than you think. It's bigger than what I thought. And the reason why I say that is I just completed the third edition of the Mastering Engineer's Handbook. And I went back around and I talked to all these mastering engineers, a lot who now brought their lathes out of storage and have them set up. And to a man, they all said, you know what, we go 24/7 on our lathe, or lathes, they may have several, and a lot of them are like 2 weeks, 3 weeks behind. And then every single pressing plant is to capacity right now. Then on top of it, Doug Sachs, the famous legendary mastering engineer, was telling me that there was a turntable company, and I can't remember the name, that sold over 1 million turntables last year.
Wow.
And where they sold them mostly was Urban Outfitters.
Yeah, I see. You know, you oddly see those. Like I think there's a brand like Crossfire or something, you
like
see
that
at Bed Bath & Beyond and all kinds of those places that just don't expect to see that.
Now, are they good? I can't tell you, but it does show you that there's a trend, and it's not people our age. It's, you know, Generation Y, millennials that are buying them. And I always ask, whenever I give a clinic or something at a college, I always ask, okay, who has vinyl? I'm always surprised the number of people have vinyl. And I ask them, okay, so do you listen all the way through, you know, as opposed to just needle drop? And surprisingly enough, it does change listening habits as well.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, do you think convenience, the whole reason MP3s and the sort of downloads is convenience, is why it works really well. Do you think that sound quality with something like what Neil Young's Pono. I'm totally killing the name, as I always do with every word. But do you think that sound quality is going to win? Like, you know, basically people are going to go back to sound quality?
I wish I could say yes, but no. Yeah. Convenience always wins, unfortunately. There's a lot of expectations about Pono, but they're there for the wrong reason. I think, well, if they're smart, Neil Young and company are just thinking that they have a niche market, that there's going to be just X number of people that are going to really dig it and are going to buy it. And it's not going to go beyond that, because that's kind of the way it's going to work out. The people want convenience, and that is not going to be convenient, believe me, because you have to buy a funny shaped player that, although it may sound great, it's supposed to sound terrific, you still have to download the files, and it's a high res download. It takes a long time. It's not going to be convenient.
Well, the other thing is the Pono only plays FLAC files, and
I don't think it does. I think it plays everything.
It might play waves, but there are players that are roughly the same price that play DSD and play some of the other formats that are not comp, but they're high end formats.
Yeah.
But speaking of high res, you see this big onslaught of people with vinyl because they claim that it sounds better. Do you think that stuff like SACD or DVD audio, do you think they're still viable, or why are you not seeing that? Because basically they should even have more frequency response and a flatter sound than vinyl.
They should have been, shoulda, woulda, coulda, you know, when there was the chance for that to break through. The record labels really didn't deliver in time, and they missed the window, unfortunately. And now, again, it's a piece of physical product that most people don't want to own. So I think that window is closed for sure. I hate to say it, but I do believe Apple now is going to come out with the high-res part of iTunes, or high-res streaming service, and have a pretty high-res with Beats.
Yeah, well, the brilliant thing with iTunes is what I was reading about was for years now they've requested 96K 24-bit files.
So for a year and a half.
For about a year and a half. So they've had a lot of people delivering that. So already they have the files. So when they open it, they'll have a lot of product automatically. But now I'm seeing downloads for DSD. You can get DSD files, and there are players for that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I have super audio CDs, and I've listened to stuff, and I've had stuff that's just blown my ears away. They're just really good. And it's like, you know, in the pursuit of, as an audiophile, in pursuit of that, there are viable files. And then there's places like HD Tracks that just, that's their whole thing. They just have high-end files of masters, of original masters.
You know what the scary part is about high-res the mastered for iTunes files that are 9624? And actually, mastered for iTunes, they consider that high-res if it's 24-bit. It could be 44.1.
Yeah.
But if it's 24-bit, they consider it high-res. A lot of the mastering guys I talk to tell me in confidence, and I can't tell you some of these artists, but they're huge. They'll receive files that instead of being 24-bit and 96K, they might be 44.1, 16-bit, that they get into master, and then they request an upsample for mastered for iTunes at 96K. So even though it's supposed to be full 96K resolution, it starts out at something that's truncated. Yeah. It's very less than that. And the good part about HD tracks is they do actually go in and look at the resolution. They use a bit scope to see exactly what, you know, what's going on. Bob Ludwig told me that there was a plug-in that Universal Audio had. Whatever, it's a tape saturator. Mm. And unfortunately, it's 16-bit. So people use it and they think it's great in 96K, and all of a sudden they find out that their master is truncated, and they don't find out until later.
Yeah.
So sadly, the same thing happens to the video world.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
You would not believe how many studios will come in and say, hey, I've got this old film. Yeah. Can you now make it HD? Provide me an HD source. No, I only have the SD.
Yeah.
It's...
Yeah, I've seen a lot of older television shows. They've up-res. And then there's the other thing. I'm curious what you think also, too, because I know Neil Young, before Pono, he was a big proponent of Blu-ray audio using like a DTS HD master stream. Do you think that's just going to be small, or you don't think that'll ever?
Yes. I don't think it'll ever catch on.
Because, see, that's the thing. If you have it on the disc, you can make it into a file.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about DTS HD is it, even though it's lossless, it's still it's a smaller bit throughput. It's still a bigger file, but it's a smaller throughput. So on a player, it actually, you know, you don't need a lot of processing power to play it.
And a lot of bandwidth, yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like you can, it'll, you know, anything that's on a disc can be a file, which means it can be downloaded.
But again, if you look at the history of the music business, it was never about quality. It's always about convenience.
Yeah.
Go back to sheet music and work your way forward. It's always convenience. I mean, you know, you can look at what happened with the cassette. Why did the cassette take off? Because it was clearly an inferior format, but it was more convenient. You couldn't have a vinyl record player in your car.
It's portable.
Although I did happen to see one last week in Isaac Hayes' car at the Stax Museum. Isaac Hayes and... Was it 1972, right after his really, really big hit, he went and he bought a gold-plated Cadillac. And this thing was tricked out. It had a refrigerator, and it had a television, one of the, you know, little like 11-inch television, and it also had a record player.
Wow.
Yeah, way back when.
If he hits a speed bump, God help us.
Yeah. I heard Elvis had one, too.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of car, I think that was a big reason. I think a lot of the disc format, especially like DVD audio and SACD, I never understood why there's never been an SACD player for the car.
Yeah.
I mean, there is one now, but it's like for a Maserati or something like that. I mean, and everybody I talked to from Panasonic when they were pushing DVD audio, they had said surround is made for the car.
Yeah.
I missed the boat. Yeah, I think you've said SACD more than it has been said probably by anyone else in the past years.
Sorry. I'm just...
I know, you're sad.
I'm very sad. not that because of that format, just, you know, the audio is incredible. Some of the stuff I've heard mastered for those formats are just it's, some of the stuff that you did are just killer DVD, some of the DVD audio stuff that you did.
Yeah, I've done a lot of, I did 125 projects, I think, by, you know, a lot of major stars, actually. But there again, I won't name the projects, but several times you couldn't get the master tapes. They didn't have the master tapes. So you would get a two-track. You wouldn't have the multi-track.
Wanted to get it from the... But, I mean, did you get the EQ master or did you get the original mix master?
Oh, EQ master. And then it would be, well, can you make 5-1 out of that? And of course, we had techniques to be able to do it. Before, you know, you had upsample from TC Electronic, we had a way to do it to make it work with the brute force method with the way you'd mic the room, mic the walls and things like that, which sounded very realistic, but it wasn't the real thing.
Right.
I remember that this was one of the saddest projects I had from the standpoint that it never came to fruition. I had a Cheap Trick album that came in, and I got the multi-track finally, and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be great. I'll be able to mix it and surround. And it was, you know, 2-inch tape. They hadn't transferred it to Pro Tools. At that time already, people were doing that. But they just sent the master, or I thought it was the master. And I put it on the machine. I hit rewind, and it exploded into a million pieces. And I thought, oh, my God, what's going to happen? And luckily, it was a copy. But then they just decided they weren't going to do the project after that. So I never did get to do it, unfortunately. And I really love Cheap Trick.
Was it edits? Was it spliced?
No, it was just it was some old AGFA, which didn't stand the test of time.
Wow.
Let's put it like that.
I'm scared now because I've used AGFA. I got to go check my master.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I should since we're in the middle of the show, I should announce the two winners of the book.
Yeah, let's. And they're autographed.
Yep, they're autographed by Bobby. So Marcus Manderson and Steve Garnett are the winners.
Marcus Anderson?
Manderson, M-A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. And Steve Garnett. So I'll be emailing you later tonight so I can get your address and send these out to you.
Congratulations, Marcus and Steve. You're going to love the book. You're going to love this book. It's killer.
I hope you enjoy it, yes.
So speaking of the book, how do you think YouTube has changed the musician today?
Well, one way is you can actually make money at it. And you can make some good money under the right circumstances if you know how to play the game. That being said, it's also easy to not make money, to spend a lot of time, spin your wheels for nothing. So the musician has to know a little bit more than just music. You have to know social media, and you have to know how to use it for promotion. And that takes some time, unfortunately, because now we're talking, you know, another skill that you have to develop. And you know, it's funny because we used to talk about the fifth Beatle. The fifth Beatle was George Martin, the producer. And now the fifth Beatle is the social media person for a band. And rightfully so. I mean, every artist needs a good social media presence.
Yeah, I mean, social media and multimedia, really, actually. Yeah. Just, you know, be able to do it all, video, everything.
Although, you know, it's funny. When it comes to the videos, and I've talked to lots of indie and major labels about this, they're changing their view of what constitutes a good video for an artist. It used to be you needed a high budget, or you seemed like you needed a high budget produced music video. But they've been finding that just putting up a lyric video, for instance, gets almost as many hits and makes almost as much money.
Right.
In many cases. Now, if you look at Beyonce
Yeah.
It doesn't really count on the 0.1%. But for everybody else, it's a big deal. And they've found, in fact, that they could put up nothing but a picture of the artist with the song playing. And they'd get almost as many views. Wow. And it costs them nothing to do. So it's very cost effective. And that's one of the things I would urge all artists to do. Don't wait to do an official music video. The day your song is released, wherever it's released, have a video up. And it could be just a lyric video. It could be just a picture of the band with your website address on it. And you know, obviously you can do more, but if you just want to do it down and dirty, just have that up at least. And you can always do the music video later because, as you know, it takes time, you know, to do it really
to do one good. I mean, but I mean, still, if it's done nice and tasteful, it could be. It could be. It looks good, but you have to have some kind of quality in the video, right? Yeah. You just can't shoot some real.
And you know, editing. I mean, it really, it all comes down to post production, and just like, it comes down to a really good mix on a song,
right?
And it's the same thing with the video. You know, you can shoot all you want and have great shots, but you really need somebody behind the scenes to put it together. And a lot of times, you know, I got to say, musicians, I've found musicians, because I was in the video business. I produced a couple of TV shows. One was guitar-oriented, as a matter of fact. It was...
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I can't think of it right now. Anyway, what I found was that the best editors, at least for music, were always musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a hotshot editor that was, you know, really good at doing commercials or something like that, that just could not feel where the edits ought to be on a music video. or just a, you know, a show that had narration, for instance. They just could not feel it.
Yeah.
But musicians always could. Musicians always
could. Well, I remember seeing some of the music videos, even on MTV. I mean, obvious things, like they go to the guitar solo and they're showing the singer and he's just sitting there. It's just like, what are you doing? It's like, show the guitar player. He's doing a solo or something like, you know, that.
Guitar Universe.
Guitar Universe.
Yes, it was the name of the show.
Oh, I think I, you guys like interviewed ZZ, or Billy Gibbons.
Billy
right?
Gibbons is one of them. Yeah,
that, part of California Vintage. You guys did over at California
Vintage. Yeah, we did, yeah.
Okay, I've seen those.
Yeah.
Yep, yep. So one of the things I want to ask you is, you know, like back in the 80s and 90s, you know, when I was a kid and whatever, when everybody was in a, you know, their own little garage band, the big thing was to get signed. That's how you knew you made it, right? You got to get signed. What, for a band today, what is it, how do they feel like they've made it? Because maybe the record label isn't as important anymore.
Well, there's a phrase that's going around that I guess I subscribe to, and it's making a living is the new success. And it used to be that getting signed or becoming a star or, you know, just having a number one record or gold record or whatever, that was a sign of success. Not anymore. It's if you could play music for a living, you've pretty much done it. You've made it. And because there's so many niches involved, you know, there's the whole rule, and it's in the book, Music 4.0 book, about the 1,000-fan rule.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that number kind of varies, but basically the idea is if you have a core audience, they'll support you forever, no matter what you do. And as long as you know how to treat them and you put out product in a timely fashion, they'll buy everything, you know, that you have. So there's that... that whole thing of if, and here's something else I subscribe to. I don't believe there's any such thing as bad music. I don't care what it is. I think it's all great. It may not be great to me, but somewhere out there, there's 100 people in the world that will absolutely love that music.
Mm-hmm.
So who's to say what's good or bad? Because what I don't dig or you don't dig, there's going to be somebody out there that does.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us hope, because if you find those 100,000 people or you know, whatever it is, if you find those people, you can make a pretty good living. And that's the beauty of the world we live in today. It's finding them that's hard, I agree. But once you do, you can actually do okay.
Yeah, well, we've seen some of the... I mean, I've talked to other people that are newer bands, so to speak. They're not established artists. And they tour a lot, and they sell their CDs on their tours, and they have a following that follows them on Facebook and on their webpage, and they let them know when they're playing, and they always show up.
Yeah.
It's very loyal. It's very consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a beauty in the world we live in today, the social media world we live in, and there's also cruelty involved. And the cruelty is it's not as easy to go from A to B than it used to be. And, you know, again, like you say, it used to be that getting a record deal, you felt like you've crossed a chasm. And not many people feel that way anymore, because a record label, you know, obviously is exploitive, especially to a young artist. And you're a lot better off to build up the audience yourself to a point where the record label comes calling and you can strike a better deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's actually the way to do it these days.
Actually, that we were talking about Neil Young. He was big enough. He got big enough when he went over to Reprise. He was lucky enough to, and it probably was his manager that did this deal, but he licensed his masters.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't have the advance, which came in very important. When CDs came out, he pretty much dictated what he wanted because he owned everything.
Yeah.
So he just licensed it to them, and basically he was able to do that. But and it was interesting, you point out in the book too, that for example, a young artist would say that as a new artist, I signed with Warner Brothers. For me to make any money, because there's no, you know, the days of the big advances and stuff are gone, but for you to make the money, I'd have to sell maybe over 1 million units to get something, and maybe not that much. Whereas these guys that are selling their CDs when they play, that they're producing themselves, if they get 100,000, they're making some good money.
Well, they're making great money at 100,000, but it's the same thing with streams. You can actually make money with YouTube and streams. There's a school of thought that I believe in that right now streaming is going to be, I don't want to say gold mine, but it's going to actually fill in the gaps where today's musician is not making the money that they used to. And for instance, what you hear a lot is someone will say, well, I had 3 million streams and all I got was $18. You hear that a lot. The whole thing with that is there was a lot more money generated. It just all didn't flow down to the artist, and not many of them realize that. So if you control your master and you control your publishing, you can actually make a lot more money from streams. The other thing, too, is right now there's only 30 million subscribers, streaming subscribers worldwide, only 30 million. Now, people are starting to make money already from streaming, and can you imagine what it's going to be like when there's 100 million, 150 million?
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly, there's some real money. The pie just got a lot bigger from streaming, and now we're talking some real money that's going to be coming in. Does it all come down to the artist? Well, probably not like usual, but you know, there is going to be money coming in from a lot more different sources.
But if you become big, let's say that you're, like, for example, with YouTube, and you're starting to get 1 million views. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but I mean, that can happen. Do you have can you negotiate with YouTube, or is it fixed?
As a matter of fact, it's a 55-45 split. But when you get to the 1 million per month views, and it has to be kind of in that neighborhood where it doesn't have to be exactly 1 million, but it has to be fairly high per month, you can sign up with a multi-channel network. Multi-channel network is a network of networks. And that they have a sweetheart deal with YouTube. And that will enable the split to go 75-25, even 85-15. Depending on, you know, how many views you have. So you can start to make a lot more money. Plus there's cross-promotion with all the other channels that they have. And that's how a lot of people are making money. And I know some people that are doing multi-channel networks, and the number of six-figure checks that they give out a month is pretty amazing, I got to say. Now, obviously, you really need a lot of views for that. A lot of traffic. But, you know, again, we look at views. 1 million is not that much. When you get to 50 million on something, that's when you start to have a hit. And really, it's past 100 where you can say, I'm talking 100 million views, and that sounds like a huge amount, and it is. But really, that's the threshold when you can say, I have something that's really hit on YouTube. So you think about 1 million, but 1 million is the lowest entry point.
Yeah, there's plenty of cat videos at 1 million views.
Yeah, right.
Which aren't, you know, don't deserve to have that. When there's plenty of people that put a lot of work into videos.
Yes, agreed.
And then it's cumulative, too. If, like Scott, he's got, you've got hundreds of videos on now, don't you?
Yeah, I'm just under 200 videos on.
So he, people start looking at the other ones.
Yeah.
And it, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So it does do that. And the streaming, too, that is that opened up or is it pretty... Is you were saying that not too many people get that much money after it trickles down, or is that negotiable?
No, it isn't. Well, yes, from the standpoint that it depends on who's controlling the royalty. So do you have a record label in the middle? And what is your deal? Is it a 50-50 deal at the record label, or is it a, let's say, an 80-20 deal where the label gets 80%. Mm-hmm. Then publishing. Okay, do you have a publisher in the middle, and what's your deal there? And who's getting the money first? Is the record label getting it and then paying it to the publisher, which, you know, is kind of shaky to begin with, and then you getting your, you know, your portion later. So that all makes a difference, and that's kind of the problem. That being said, now we have so many other places. We have Beats now. Well, of course, that's Apple, but it's still going to be another avenue. Pretty soon there's going to be Amazon. Amazon mm-hmm. just announced their streaming network is going to be part of Amazon Prime. Google is coming out with a YouTube streaming music service. And that's really close. And then you have Deezer, which is the big Spotify competitor in Europe. And they're supposed to launch in North America pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
So you just look at those, for instance, and all of a sudden you have four or five additional sources of income.
Yeah. You also mentioned in the book, which I thought was really important, is the evolution. You were talking about, well, okay, the record companies are they've condensed down to three big ones, and their whole influence has changed. But there's this new paradigm. And you give Irving Azoff as an example, where he has a management company, he has a social media company, he has a video production company, live event production company. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's important. It seems to me, instead of looking for a record deal, you're looking for a management type of that's what you would be looking for.
Well, management is probably the most important thing you can have. I guess it always has been, really, but even more so now. And if you look at what Irving did, he took his management company and he merged it with Madison Square Garden Company. And they've come up with what looks to be the prototype of the record label of the future, I think, anyway. Because what they have is venues. Madison Square Garden Company has venues all over the country. And there's management, of course. And then they have a social media division, and then they have a video production division as well. And I have one more division I can't think of right off. Oh, branding. So you look at that and you think, okay, what don't they have? Well, they don't have distribution. But guess what? That's easy to get now. You can go to what they call label services at a major record label, and you can just basically say, okay, I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and then pay for it. So that's not a problem anymore. So any management company could actually do this. They were just, Azoff was just smart enough to take it to the extreme sort of right out of the box. Now, this started last September when I think they did this. We haven't really seen a lot of evidence of this putting out something new, but I think, you know, it's a time factor. It's putting it all together.
Well, it's like a one shop, so you can play live. He can video it. You have the social media to push it, and you have the manager to demand the good money for it.
No, I think it's brilliant, actually, and kind of the way of the future for record labels, anyway.
So that would be the focus if you were going to go for, if you were going to try to get some type of deal or something. It's the focus on a really good management package.
Yeah, because again. One of the things, and the artist who actually changed all this was Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, where they changed everything last year. by kind of hiring out what they needed. They stayed independent when they could have. They had suitors all over the place, major record labels that were throwing money at them, and they decided they were going to go indie. And they turned around and they said, okay, we're going to hire out the radio promotion from Warner Brothers. And they just paid them, I think it was 3% or something, instead of signing the normal record deal. You don't have to do that anymore. You can go to a major record label and say, I want this service, that service, that service, that service, and let's negotiate.
Pick what you want.
Yeah. And that's kind of the new paradigm as well. That's changed everything completely, and I don't think people have seen or understand how important that is for an artist.
Yeah, it just gives you a lot more freedom because you were dependent on what they said.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like, in another sense, like clubs. It used to be, you know, you would play clubs and work. Now it's pay to play in certain cities.
Yeah, a lot of places.
You have to pay to get into the, you pay them to play in their club, which to me as a musician, it's like, that is just so wrong on many levels, yeah. But...
Well, they veil it by saying, buy these 200 tickets and you can make money if you sell them all. But, you know, yeah. That never happens, of course.
It's nice to be able to, that'd be great if I wanted to do radio promotion. I just hired Warner Brothers because they have that, especially internationally, they're strong in promotion and PR.
Well, let's come back now where it sounds like everything I'm saying is don't sign with the record label. But there is a place and time where you need a record label, you know, a major record label. After someone becomes a star, the only way they can go to the superstar level is with the major label. No one's done it so far. Well, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis has. But you've seen Nine Inch Nails now go back with the record label after being successful as an independent. Trying to think that there's another major artist that just went back as well, and I can't think of who it is off the top of my head. But anyway, the reason why you need a major record label is because they have the infrastructure to be able to put you in places that you could never do yourself worldwide to become a global artist. And an indie can do it a fairly good job locally. Locally meaning in the country they're in.
Right.
But they can't do it on a global level very easily. You can sell, but you can't promote. You don't have the infrastructure to be able to do it the way you really need to.
Using traditional promotion like radio, television.
Or even social media. I mean, you can do a lot. But once again, what a record label is really good at is traditional media like radio. They're really good at that. They're really good at getting product out. They're really good at promotion where they need it. And they're, you know, they have the bucks to be able to do it. They have the deep pockets. So that's why, you know, there is a place for them. They're not going to go away.
Do they help you? Do the record labels help you a lot when you want to tour out of the country? Because that's another thing that, I mean, it's, we kind of know what to do around here, you know, locally or around the United States. It's pretty straightforward. But to like tour Europe or Japan, do you need them or do you need something else?
No, but generally speaking, you already have an agent. And the agent will either have ties to other agents or, you know, their company will have a presence, okay. You know, in Europe.
So you still have to get an agent.
You still need an agent. Yeah. An agent makes the deals for you. Mm-hmm.
Well, Bobby, we want to definitely thank you so much. And out of time. But for those of you listening and you weren't the two lucky winners, definitely go out and pick up his book, Music 4.0, A Survival Guide to
and also,
Music on the Internet.
Also, because I've been looking at it, and I downloaded some of these on Kindle. The rest of these are on Kindle. Deconstructed Hits, where he goes through each of certain classic songs and breaks down what they did, how they got the sound, how they engineered it. The personnel, the whole story, killer. I mean, if you want to know what happened with Stairway to Heaven, that'll tell you, and what guitars and all that stuff. He also did, he has another book called Social Media Promotion, which kind of is like an addendum to this book, where it really gets into how to get that all together. And my favorite, The Recording Engineer's Handbook, which talks about microphones, techniques, and his surround section in there. And so I recommend you guys check all these things out. You can get them on Amazon.
Yeah.
And his website is www.bobbyosinski.com, O-W-S-I-N-S-K-I.com.
Yep. And he has quite a few different blogs and all kinds of stuff, as you would expect somebody who writes books about social media.
Yeah, and a new podcast.
Well. Oh, cool. And you also have a blog. He has a blog, too.
Yep. So
check his website for that. We're going to have you back. I have to talk to you about miking, and I have to talk to you about surround. So
and guitar tone as well.
Yes, exactly. Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you so much. And everybody, have a great week. We'll see you next week.
I want to thank Sweetwater, too. Thank you.